Welcome to Health Media Now with award-winning author and host Denise Messenger for a lifetime of health empowerment. Live by being in the pink, meaning P stands for being persistent, I stands for using your intuition, N stands for networking, and K stands for obtaining knowledge. Our guests entertain and share cutting-edge information. They share with you what may have taken years to achieve through experience in their field. Become inspired and motivated. Reach your full potential with fascinating tips and products. Receive a lifetime of benefits from authors, doctors, practitioners, healthcare providers, and learn about exciting new products. You asked for it, and we deliver. Now, here's your host, Denise Messenger.
Welcome, listeners, to our great show today, which is February 21st, 2018. We're quite privileged and honored to have Dr. Craig, is it Weiner or Weiner? How do you
Weiner.
Pronounce your last name?
Yeah.
Weiner? Okay.
Yeah.
To have Dr. Craig Weiner back on our show. He was with us probably a couple of years ago. And our subject matter today is going to be on parenting your child with ADHD. Give a little background. He's a licensed psychologist. He's based in Worcester, Massachusetts, where he specializes in the treatment of children, adolescents, and families. He obtained his doctorate degree from the Clark University, and he's a member of the American Psychological Association and the Massachusetts Psychological Association. He has over 30 years of private practice, and he's also an assistant professor of the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at University of Massachusetts Medical School. And he's also clinical director of mental health services at Family Health Center of Worcester. So this is an extremely busy man, and we're going to get right into the interview. Welcome. Welcome.
Well, hi. It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about parenting children with ADHD. What have you found to be the biggest obstacles?
Well, the first obstacle, of course, is the kind of indoctrination that our social group has had with ADHD for the past 50 years. It's been more and more the medical field persuading people to see this as a biogenetic problem that it limits the child's possible functioning. So that what happens is, as people believe this way of understanding the behavior pattern, there's a greater likelihood of people feeling that medication and taking more control of the child's management is necessary because the child is considered limited by a condition that's basically genetic in origin and that makes them more likely to show hyperactive, impulsive, and distracted behaviors. So parents often get the sense that they really have to take over and give medications to offset this disability. That's the first hurdle, because in many ways I approach the problem very differently and try to help the parent address how people come to this conclusion and that you could come to a very different understanding of these behaviors. Even in light of all the research that's presented, you can be they're finding out more and more now that long-term use of these ADHD medications really aren't yielding long-term benefits, even though in the short term the child shows improvements in sitting in a chair and completing work, but in long term they're not really showing benefits in education achievement and life adjustment.
Kind of difficult to change that paradigm, isn't it, since it's been going on for so long?
Yeah, and it's going on with all the diagnostic categories because people come to see their struggles in life as caused by their biology rather than as a function of developing slowly over long periods of time and learning to live in the world and cope with the kind of world they're encountering.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can help a person come to understand that what they're doing is very understandable in light of the conditions that they've dealt with and had to adjust to, they can see their behavior is adaptive, even though there are secondary side effects, secondary consequences to all the solutions we have. So you might solve one thing by doing one behavior, but it also creates a cascade of other problems. So it's, we're all struggling with how to operate in the world.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, how does our high-tech society affect these children?
Well, you know, you get kids and they're really focused and connected to their phones and video games and social media, so that it's they're almost bonded to this stuff. When they go to restaurants with their family or spend time with the family, everybody's got a phone out. Even in therapy sessions, the phone's ringing constantly, and it might distract people from each other and make relationships a little bit different, because the person can kind of shut the text off when they want. They don't have to learn to do a mutual exchange. So it's the kind of give and take that comes with operating with a real person. So there might be some behaviors that aren't being learned as readily if you're dealing with an object that you can control or act upon versus a person who you're interrelating with. It's a very different behavior.
Well, with an ADHD child, I would think it would be quite complicated. Number one, it's a big distraction, which is what you're saying. But the behavioral side needs to be addressed with parents, I would think, relative to one-on-one communication.
Yeah, I think that the whole thing is forming a relationship with the child. And by having a relationship, the cooperation goes with it. So that if the child and parent aren't interacting very much, so what's the likelihood that anybody goes out of their way to be kind and helpful and caring if the relationship is kind of distant and there's not much going on, people aren't really involved with each other's lives? There's no sense of camaraderie or mutual caring. So you want to, now I'm not saying that you can't have that with the electronics. You just have to shape it. And the kids, kids will give up the electronics if there's options to have relationships. I don't see it necessarily one supplanting the other, but it might, because kids always had other things that they were going to do. And it's a little bit harder. Who even knows? We don't have long-term data on any of this. It's a new generation that's even being exposed to this stuff early on.
Are the ADHD children, are their brains wired differently from a child that doesn't have ADHD?
Some people like to say that, but if you look at the data very closely, some studies will come out with the difference between kids diagnosed with ADHD and the size of different brains and the differentiation of the structures or the way in which the brain has neurotransmitters, but repetition of the studies say that it doesn't always show any difference. And the other thing is, they might just be measuring the consequence of behaving in the world in a certain way, because I'm sure brains of psychologists look differently than brains of non-psychologists, because they do studies of cab drivers in London, and they showed that the cab driver's brain was very developed in the spatial area, because that's what they did all day. They navigated through the street. So you're dealing with the consequences of behavior. You're not dealing with the causes of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not studying or doing your own self-management and somebody's doing it for you, how is your brain going to develop the same way as if you train yourself to get up and you're training yourself to remind yourself about things or to coordinate your schedule or to figure out complex problems instead of saying, I can't, I don't know, and then kind of moaning and groaning until somebody comes over and makes it easy for you? That's a different brain development than kid learns to struggle and learn that they can do it.
It's really an excellent point. What's the attention span of an ADHD child? Are they all different?
Well, yeah, and my view is that it's a very situational assessment, because the attention span of what's done when it's an enjoyed or initiated activity is very different from when it's an assigned or acquired or expected activity.
But that's every child.
Well, yes. Yeah, so then the problem is the kids who are more extreme in this regard get diagnosed, because we're all required to accommodate to things we don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be a function of how do you pattern somebody to learn not everything in the world is exactly what I like. And the other thing is, if I'm not good at something, I'm much less likely to practice it and participate. And that's self-fulfilling prophecy, because then I become further and further behind and more self-conscious and more avoidant. And then I become more resistive. And then the more I'm forced to do it by somebody, the more terrible it gets. And that's what
mm-hmm.
gets kids with these diagnoses into power struggles with their parents. And then it's all about what's the success rate of the child with the activity you're talking about? Because people work for long-term goals when they have the sense that if they do it, the success is possible. You don't really work long-term if you don't think you can do it. Why do you invest the
mm-hmm.
effort?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this is
frustrated.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm helping parents all the time understand the child in terms of the child's living in the world and their development.
Yeah. What advice do you have for parents with ADHD children that do not wish to continue them on the medications?
So, okay, my advice is you could do what I want to do with or without medications, but if you introduce the medications, then you have the problem of withdrawing from them. And
mm-hmm.
Sometimes if you introduce the medications, everybody gets complacent because the reports from school stop happening because the kid's more focused in. And therefore, if the parent still wants to stick to the therapy, when the urgency is reduced, that's the problem. So that you can do what I want to do without the meds, just as long as the parent knows that it might not be this urgency, which often gets people to work harder. But what I try to get parents to do is not what is often recommended, which is what parents often hear is that they have to manage the child more readily and do a higher level of monitoring and a higher level of what's called contingency management, which is you have to kind of be there to coax the kid along with bribes and rewards and punishments, because the kid has to kind of constantly be coaxed to keep doing the things you want the kid to do. And what I try to do is help the child. If ADHD doesn't happen when the child's interested, then how do we help create interest in doing the activities and achievements that we value? So that I'm trying to help the parent establish that
mm-hmm.
rather than fight the child all along with, I'll take your phone away or I'll give you this if you do this. Because then if I'm not around to keep doing that, the kid doesn't only learns to do that when I'm around with that artificially created world. And
mm-hmm.
I want the child to learn to function not just with the parent in the artificial world the parent's creating, but learn to function away from the parent in the world in which it is. Now, if
mm-hmm.
you take the belief the kid can't handle the world the way it is because of a disability, then you never permit that to happen. But I don't do that. I say, let's see if we can get the youngster to learn to be more self-reliant and learn that some of these things we want the child to do, they might enjoy and they might find success with it. It might not be so terrible. So it's helping work through the reluctance and avoidance and the anxiety about participating and trying to achieve in socially valued activities.
Mm-hmm. A lot of parents don't have previous training, in how to manage an ADHD child. Are there courses, or is it basically done by a psychologist?
Well, there's lots of professionals that are, work with kids and people who do parenting, and there's lots of programs. The problem is the parent has to kind of sift through. Most of it's going to be rewards and charts and bribes and punishments, and they're going to get a short-term effect. They're like the meds, and they're not. But the long-term is going to be the issue.
Okay.
How well does anybody come out of institutional care when they are managed by people? When they leave the institution, it's what's called institutionalized. So how are they? They're not really better off out of the institution. So you have to worry. I worry that that doesn't train the child to become the self-reliant adult.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you take the view that these kids are already doing a lot of the behaviors that we want them to do on their initiated activities that they like, it's not really teaching them something from scratch. They just don't do it with the activities we are requiring of them. They're doing it. They might read a book on how to do the video game, and they never pick up a book like that on schoolwork.
Mm-hmm.
Or they might read a Stephen King novel, but they're not going to read another kind of. Not going to read a school assignment. There's lots of
true.
They learn about professional wrestling and who's the champ and what his matches were and what the brackets are and why he's going to win or not win, or the trading cards. They know all the systems and what's valuable and how to play the game. But they're not learning the simple thing, or they don't know how to pick up their room, or leave their books in a reliable place they can find them, or put their homework in a place where they can retrieve it, or pass it in when no one's around to tell them to pass it in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
how
do people manage all these other things? They don't manage the very simplistic routines that lots of us learn to do.
I think a lot of times parents are just exhausted. You know, it's kind of like we have the two-parent household now and they both work.
So I think that's true. And how many, what kind of routines are available for family life anymore in terms of bedtimes and story times and supper times and homework time? And if you do routines, you're more likely to remember your routines because it's always...
That's true.
The activity before... cues the next activity.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that's why people who do routines achieve a lot.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. Let's go into your 10 parenting principles.
Okay, so these are, let me see, I just get the... So the first one's, as I've been talking about managing a child with coercion because of the presumption of disability, the
mm-hmm.
first parent principle I use is manage a child with the least amount of coercion.
Mm-hmm.
Coercion is your last resort, not your presumed method. So when you solve a problem with less coercion, you increase interest because you get buy-in. And if you have buy-in, you don't have to be around to force because the person sees the benefits. It's a mutually beneficial solution. Both people voluntarily know that it's in their best interest to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is staying calm. Now, one of the arguments for the ADHD crowd is that the youngster somehow has a problem regulating their emotions. They call it regulating emotions. All you know is the kid gets emotional more quickly than the other kids their age group. Now, the problem is how to account for that. A lot of times it's modeled behavior, and a lot of times it's what do people do when the child's emotional? Do we try to calm them down? Do we give in to them? Do they? What's the reinforcement of it? So we want to first help the parent recognize how are they responding to the child when the child's getting emotional? What benefits does being emotional have for the child? Now, so the first thing for the parent is going to be, if you stay calm, you're role modeling the behavior you want the child to show. Like instead of you could say, "I know you're angry, but I can hear you better if you talk quietly," or "We could solve this. We could probably solve this once we relax and calm down, because we'll be able to think better." So you just maybe giving the youngsters some ideas about, gee, it's better if we can do this calmly. We'll come up with something we can both enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's a good example.
You're training out emotionality, which is very important, because they talk about kids being impulsive. That's just really just emotionality, because everybody does a short-term gain when they're emotional. They don't really pay attention to what's going to happen when they say the things they're going to say when they're emotional. It's when they calm down, they operate differently. It's just like when you're drunk, you don't think the same way as when you're not drunk. So it's a problem of what emotionality is. A very important skill to teach a kid to how do you learn to be calm about things, to solve them. So these are often kids that you get all frustrated and upset, and if the parent feels that they're obligated to be the ones to calm the child down, then the child doesn't learn to calm themselves down. They learn that if they're upset, somebody comes over and it makes a difference for them. So why would they learn to calm down? They learn to be emotional. And you just have to go through all these instances with the parent to see
mm-hmm.
when it happens during the day.
What's so the third one?
The third one is they take steps to address and resolve problems, which means that if a parent's unhappy in their relationship with the child, they're feeling the child's exploiting or not really participating or doing things, it's important for the parent not to sit there and let the child dominate and exploit the family. So the parents say something like, "Gee, I haven't been getting enough time on the computer. Let's figure out a way to take turns." Now, if the youngster doesn't want to work with you, then you could do something more coercive. But coercive doesn't really solve anything. You have to find out, why wouldn't the child want to figure out a way to take turns? What's the big deal? Why isn't the relationship important enough for both to give and take? That's the first problem. You want to have a relationship that means it is important to each of us that we accommodate each other. Now, these kids do that with their friends all the time. You don't have to force them to do a favor for their friends. So you know that these are responses within their behavioral repertoire. It's just that they're not patterned as family behavior.
That's a good point. Patterned behavior.
Yeah. Yes. So four is patience, because what happens is, if let's say child's in therapy with me and the child puts their feet up on the chair, and I say, "Gee, that could rip the chair," and the child put the I don't say take your feet off. I let the child know that that's a problem, and then the child puts the feet down. But then, as other things happen, the feet go back up, because that's just an automatic behavior the kid's doing. Now, if I say put your feet down, and I start to get impatient with the child, then the child's not going to like the way I talk with them, and then less likely to want to accommodate me. Because now our relationship is different, because I'm treating them in a frustrated way, which says I'm angry with you or you're bad. So now the relationship is somewhat disrupted. Now it takes longer to get the behavior to stop, because now that's in the way. So if I say, I usually know it takes 3 to 4 times of just being very calm about the feet, and after a while the child stops. So, like, how fast does anybody change a habit? That's the idea, is that to recognize ahead of time that all these things that we're doing with the child and the child's doing with us, that's been reinforced and patterned in for years and years already. And that now, just because I'm doing differently, or I'm sounding nice, or I'm doing something new, it may not automatically change the first trial. It's going to take a little time to shape a relationship that's more mature in terms of give and take. But the earlier you start with your child, the better. Because you want the child to learn that they can contribute and participate
mm-hmm.
and give back early. Otherwise, the child just learns that the world revolves around me and everything that has to accommodate to me. And then you wonder why the kids aren't adjusting to what's not interesting to them, because they're used to the world accommodating to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, parenting any child, they need structure and they need boundaries.
Very much so. And that's what's kind of the boundaries and structure are relational patterns that are mutually acceptable and that,
mm-hmm.
that have an influence on the family in a positive way, that this is kind of behavior is going to cost the family lots of money if you do this, and then we have less
mm-hmm.
money available to other things. So, but kids don't learn that what they do has an impact on others and see the consequences. How are they going to learn to be managers of their own activity? So
mm-hmm.
if the parent isn't helping them see the consequences of what goes on, a lot of kids aren't really experiencing the consequences of their own failures anymore.
Yeah, I followed a child that was raised by his grandmother from the time he was 2.5, 3 years old. By the time he reached 19, he was in prison. And the grandmother never set structure or boundaries with him. He was never punished for anything ever.
Well, the grandmothers, because grandparenting is notoriously a permissive activity, that means that for me, it isn't that he wasn't punished enough. It was that she didn't really work with him to develop a mutually acceptable pattern with him.
Mm-hmm.
So she may have accommodated to him, or just made sure he was happy, or never really did anything that would get him to be upset with her. Or she didn't structure what's called a family, which is the notion that it's a group and that people contribute
mm-hmm.
and help. So maybe she felt bad for him because his parents weren't there to take care of him, and that guilt can be very difficult, because the parent who's feeling guilty is often over-accommodating, and it ends up with an outcome that you don't want.
Yeah, well, probably punished wasn't the right word. Perhaps, you know, consequences was a better term. He never had any consequences.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for his behavior.
Yeah, so the consequence, if he was reckless with things, she could say, well, we're going to have to figure out a way to pay for this. It's going to have to happen.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to really be able to go to McDonald's this week because we're going to have to spend the money on repairing this. He may not have gotten any sense of his actions had outcomes that affected
True.
Other people or anything else.
True.
That's why it's important, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what's your sixth one?
Well, I think we're on five, but
fifth
one is,
okay.
What's that?
Okay, I'm starting to lose track. There's so many.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know, as a parent, if I could remember all 10 of these, Craig.
I know. That's why I wrote them in a book. You could get the book.
There you go.
There you go.
And what's that book called, so our listeners know?
So it's called Parenting Your Child with ADHD, A No-Nonsense Guide for Nurturing Self-Reliance and Cooperation.
Good. I want everybody to know that.
Yeah.
All right, so we're on number five now.
We're almost halfway there. So the fifth one is called Suspend Judgment. Now, you know how people talk a lot about non-judgmental interactions where people don't get upset with each other about being
mm-hmm.
evaluated and judged
mm-hmm.
when they talk. It kind of gets people to clam up and not really be frank with each other or really direct and honest, so that you can get a reasonable solution that has the possibility of follow-through for people. So, and the other thing is, if you're judgmental and critical and evaluative, which is one of the situations that elicits ADHD behavior, the child usually learns to avoid or lie or sneak or say what you want to hear or clam up, and you don't really get the notion of talking and coming to some mutual outcome. So one of the ways in which I try to help parents is to how might we talk with the child so that the child isn't upset and anxious about the notion that they're going to be judged and evaluated by each thing they say. So let's take the report card scenario. The kid doesn't want to show the parent the report card because they're going to be told they didn't do well enough. And so the parent could say, this report card looks terrible. And then the kid's just going to be defensive and upset and not want to share their struggles about school or anything, or even to talk with the parent about school. You could, the alternative could be something like, well, how do you feel about the report card that you have? Now, at first, the kids are going to say, fine, and they're not, because they're going to be, if you can't get to this new place easily, because if you've already shaped the child to be anxious about what you're going to say, then you're not going to get automatically a kid who feels free to just talk with you about how they feel. But over time, it's what do you like about the report card? Is there anything about it you want to change? How do you feel about these grades? Do you have a sense about how these grades came about or what you could do to change it? Or is it something, how do you, you want to get the child talking more and you're responding more to the child. It's not, most of these things are not, most of these parenting approaches I'm advocating have to do with the child being much more in the lead and the parent responding to the child's initiatives, because it'll shape a very different kind of relationship and behavior. A lot of ADHD gets shaped by long-winded lectures. You should, you have to. And then how do you think distractibility gets trained? Who's going to listen to that?
Yeah, so parents benefit by asking open-ended questions, not closed ones.
Exactly. So I'm all for that. And and then the more the child constructs language, the more they're developing their brain. So how
Very
much
true.
Brain develop? How much brain develop do you get when the kid says, "I don't know." Yep. Okay. Sort of. I guess.
When we were raising our son, you know, that usually 5, 6, 7 year olds, they can be a challenge at times, and we used to say to him, well, that didn't go so well for you. And obviously there's consequences to what has transpired. So which option would you like? 1, 2, or 3 of the consequence side, right? And he would always set his own. He'd say, well, I guess I won't be going over to, you know, Sam's house after school for a while. But he would pick it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how it went, you know.
Well,
we never had any behavioral problems with him because he knew he had choices.
Yeah. Well, you also were reasonable with him, so I try to work the kid to maybe that would be a solution anyway, cuz it's not a bad solution. Or how would it be beneficial if he didn't go there for a while? What would be gained by that solution? What would be what's the benefit of doing it that way? Is he think something's going to happen in the meantime that would, if he went back later, maybe the family would be more receptive to him if he let some time pass? If he went back later, maybe he'd give himself some time to learn other things so that when he did go back, it could be different. So I always want the child to not to think that I'm inducing something just for its sake of imposing suffering on them. I just want to find out, well, what are we trying to solve, and what is the advantage of this, and what's the disadvantage of that? And then you get a different kind of understanding and of what's going on.
True. Very true. What's our next one?
So number 6 is say it positively. Now, this is interesting because almost everything that we say that is in the negative could be reframed in a positive way. And if you learn to talk about the positive, the child's more likely to see the advantages of something rather than the fear of it. So, and the benefit of doing it rather than the denial. So you gain a lot by the language and the form of language you're using. So you could say to a child, you can't have snacks before dinner. Now all the child's going to hear is they're being kept from something, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, or I could say, gee, let's keep our appetites. We can eat together real soon. So you're keeping your appetite, which is a benefit, and that we're going to be together soon. So that you're always trying to point them into something that is so they can see reason, the positive reason to do things. A lot of parents are managing with the fear, which is if you don't do it, I'll take this away.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than if we do it this way, this will happen. We can get this to happen, and this might be nice. Like if it's the same thing as if let's see, I had a case where the father was going to write out the child had to get a certain average in her grades for him to pay for something. And the thing is, the child would have liked to have those grades anyway. So
mm-hmm.
But the idea that she wasn't going to get that something unless she got the grades was only going to be getting angry at him because he was trying to force her, rather than, what kind of grades do you want, and what would happen if you got these grades, and what would happen for you if you got these grades, or I think it makes sense for us to get this for you if you get these grades, because then we know you're serious about doing it, and it's worthwhile for the family to invest in that. If you're serious, we'd like to be serious about supporting you.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about a whole other set of behaviors that have to do with care and facilitating, not preventing or coercing. And it's all in the language, because a lot of the notion of punishment is just the language or how you say it. Or if you don't stop doing this, I'm going to take you out of here. Or versus you, gee, they'll only let us stay if we're quiet. We're only allowed to stay here, or we could stay here longer if we make sure we're quiet. Everybody's happy if we're quiet. So the youngster talks about we get to stay rather than I'm going to take you out of here. It's all about where you're pointing the kid.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be very, very different responses are elicited depending on how things are framed. That's a customer service issue at stores. A good customer service person, how can I help you? What can we do for you? Let's see how I can help you.
That's true.
Yeah, you're doing customer service.
Mm-hmm. You just never think of it as applicable to the household, you know?
Yeah.
What's the next?
Number seven is, I think this is very important. It's called treat your child as competent to succeed. Now, you know how we were talking earlier about the presumption of disability takes parenting and intervention into a whole other direction?
Yes.
Okay. So this
Before
is
the
a
show
very,
we were talking about it.
Yeah. So this is one of the principles that if you presume your child can do it, you're relating differently to the child. Now, let's say the child's doing schoolwork, and the parent could say, you have to read the directions. Now, you're treating a child like somebody just did something wrong who doesn't know what to do, and the child's going to object to the help and the schoolwork because it's now associated with you're stupid, you don't know anything.
Yeah, that's tough.
Now, a lot of kids refuse help because it's that kind of defensiveness. They want to be treated like a baby. They don't want to be treated like they don't know. I know that. I know, they would say. So the parent, instead of saying you have to read the directions, you could say, how can you find out what to do? So you're asking the child, and the child would tell you. Now the child's competent. Because they're giving the answer. So
that's
it's very
a great
tricky.
One.
Yeah, it's very, very tricky about if a parent just pays attention to these kinds of things as a first step.
Mm-hmm.
Not even think
mm-hmm.
about changing, but think about all the things that are said with the presumption that I'm treating the child like they didn't know, rather than they're doing something. The child may not have been doing the schoolwork, but not because they didn't read the directions. Maybe they didn't read the directions. They're afraid they weren't going to want to do it, or they were angry about doing it, or they wanted to do something else. But I'm saying I'm treating them like they didn't know that, versus they know they weren't doing it. It's remarkable in our society how we presume people don't know things. Now,
mm-hmm.
there may be times when people don't know things if you live in isolation or you're restricted from certain kinds of information. But a lot of times, like we were talking about earlier, a lot of these things that kids are doing all the time in other situations and circumstances, they're already doing it. They know where to put their stuff where they can find it. It's very
mm-hmm.
important for them to... If it's important for their sister not to take it from them, they'll hide something. So they know exactly where not to put it. Yet they leave their stuff all over the ground like they don't know where to put things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's not an issue of incompetence. It's an issue of what would account for them to do this behavior in this way with these things in these situations, and another behavior another way with another situation with other people in different settings. So you can see ADHD is a very subtle, nuanced pattern of behavior that it doesn't really get solved by saying it's caused by your genes. There's no gene that even predicts the diagnosis, let alone anything else. How they keep getting away with that, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So number eight is establish buy-in, which we've been talking about all along. When your child's comfortable with what is happening, the child's much more likely to cooperate and follow through.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Now, this is a very subtle thing, because you could say to a kid, I don't want you touching that toy again, or I don't want you touching that thing on the desk. And you could just walk away, or you could look at the kid and say, it's important that you leave this stuff on the desk alone. And then look at the child and see if the child nods that they're okay with that. Like, check to see that you're interested in whether they're agreeing or willing to do that. So you get a very different set of behaviors if you acknowledge somebody's, it's called a social regulator, if you acknowledge whether somebody's happy or displeased with what you've just said. And you could tell if somebody's buying in by whether they're nodding or giving you a certain kind of facial expression that says, okay, I'm all right with that. And it's a respect that you're giving to somebody that really translates into a very different set of relationships and patterns and follow-throughs.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that one.
So
what's
number
nine?
Nine is, what's that? We're on nine, yeah. Number nine is called assert yourself. Now, that goes back with the grandmother story where we're wondering whether the grandma was really sticking up for what was best for her and him, rather than just what was best for him,
mm-hmm.
or what she thought she was doing best for him by making sure he didn't have any disappointments or limits. But it may be that she ended up washing dishes and sweeping floors and picking up things and really being the maid. And what parent really wants to do that? And is it
mm-hmm.
any? It's not really good for a kid to think that the people they're living with are going to service them that way. So let's say the parent's noticing that certain snacks are bought and the one youngster's eating up all the snacks before the siblings. Those are good examples. So the parent can just say nothing, could say, I'm going to hide the snacks. then dole them out. Then the child doesn't learn anything because the parent's managing it. Or the parent, what if the parent said, I'm happy to keep buying these snacks if we figure out a way to share them? So the parent can say, I'm going to buy them, but I'm only going to buy them under some conditions where the kids are all happy with the way they're sharing it, and the kids are going to tell me whether they're happy the way they're sharing it. Otherwise, I can stop buying them, but it's up to you to figure out a way to share them. But I'm not going to keep buying something if I – I'm glad to buy these candies if you feel comfortable if you're throwing the wrappers away in the trash. But why buy them and I have to pick up the wrappers?
Mm-hmm.
So you, we can do this as long as I know you're doing that. So you're paying attention to a limit that you're establishing. Parents are limiting exploitations and harms, but they're not telling the child as much what to do. The child is figuring out what to do. I'm telling them the limits of what I'm going to do. You're running the family. You're running the rules of the game in some ways, or the patterns of the game, and they can learn to operate. But you don't have to be forced to buy snacks because the child's screaming. If then the child sticks me with the papers, that doesn't make any sense.
Oh my gosh. Being a parent is a big job.
Well, yeah, because all of us have trouble with how do you get a relationship that's mutually comfortable?
Mm-hmm.
How many people are successful at that with each other, at work, with their spouses, with their children? That's a pretty complex thing to do.
It really is.
Yeah, and that's the solution to ADHD is, in my view, this. It's not just if you just want to control your kid more, you'll get a short-term benefit as long as the kid's in front of you and you have the power to do it. But you don't think the kid's you're going to produce the outcome at the end that you're looking for.
True.
That's
may not be there.
What's that?
I said that outcome just might not be there.
That outcome
and
may
it's
not
too
be
late.
There.
It's too and late to be, go back.
That's the danger. Is so many kids nowadays are only seeing their pediatrician and being put on a stimulant, and then it's kind of late because by the time they're 10 and 11, 12 and 13 and 14, you're losing the opportunities, you don't even have the same impact on a child, the same chance of influencing them. And all the learning and brain development that's occurred is now their pattern and have response patterns that are very much more difficult to change.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to start as early as you can.
Was it Hitler that said, give me a child up to 6 years old? And he would have them for life, or something like that?
Yeah.
Because he could pattern them?
Yeah, so you can influence your child more at the beginning. I think the ADHD stuff has to be, like if you notice your child is very active and starting with that behavior of you sit down in the room and they go right for every object that they know they're not supposed to touch. So that's like 18 months old, they're doing all that, and if you could help a parent early on resolve that problem of the kid gets control of the room by touching the wrong things. And once the child learns that, they get control of the room by their hyperactivity is the way to get control of a room, monopolize a room, and then you're into all these other patterns that go right with it, which is how does the child get what they want? And what behaviors are they learning to do to pull people to be involved with them? Because when they go to school, the teacher doesn't want to deal with them as the only child in the room. They're not going to monopolize the teacher like they monopolize the parent.
That's true.
So it's
really
5
true.
Years later, and they've been doing that for 5 years, running the family.
Okay. Oh,
that's
boy.
Right.
Okay. Well, we're going to be running out of time soon, so let's touch on number 10.
All right, we got 10 is really what we've been talking about all along, which is foster independence.
Okay.
So instead of ordering your child's meal at a restaurant, what if the child ordered his own meal? What if the child learned to set their own alarm clock? What if the child figured out where would they put their backpack so they would remember it in the morning? What if the child did all these things and figured out what to do? And if they don't do it, you're shaping this over time by slow, steady. But it's you can see the emphasis is very different from the emphasis that most parents are probably told if their kid's diagnosed with ADHD. None of this is emphasized.
Mm-hmm.
What's emphasized is gain control over your kid.
Yes, that's really what your whole informational interview has been about today.
Yeah.
It's a different paradigm.
Yeah.
A different way of thinking, different way of raising your children, whether they have ADHD or not.
Yeah.
You know? Huh. Well, why don't you tell our listeners again about your book and where it can be purchased? That would be really helpful.
Okay, so it's called, I'm Craig Wiener, and it's called Parenting Your Child with ADHD, A No-Nonsense Guide for Nurturing Self-Reliance and Cooperation. And you could get it on Amazon. As far as I know, Barnes & Noble throughout the country was stocking copies of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you could get it on all the online stores. So it's readily, it should be readily available. Libraries and have it. And
great.
So hopefully
it'll
be helpful.
It's been an absolute pleasure having you back. Thank you so very much for taking time out of your very, very busy practice and teaching.
Well,
really,
thank you for having me.
I
appreciate that you had me, and I enjoyed it to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Craig Wiener. Take care.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, that concludes our interview for today. Thank you so much for listening. Please join us again next Wednesday, 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which is also 7 p.m. New York. Bye-bye for now. Be well.
We celebrate our listeners worldwide and invite you to contact Denise at www.healthmedianow.com with any questions you may have, and follow her on Twitter at Health Media Now and Facebook at Health Media Now. For those interested in an advertising campaign on her show, contact Lisa at knowledgeworkspub.com. Be sure to visit gotcancernowwhat.com for information on Denise Messenger's award-winning book, Got Cancer, Now What?